Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning. We talk about Turkey this hour of the program. Demonstrations in Turkey recently have been the biggest anti-government disturbances in many, many years, challenging the power of Prime Minister Erdogan, who's been in power since 2003. The demonstrators are mostly secular-minded Turks, and they have taken to the streets, airing their frustrations at the Prime Minister's abrasive and non-compromising style, heavy-handed, they say, police response to protests. And it all started, interestingly enough, we'll hear more about this, about the green spaces in Istanbul and the idea to put together a mall in the central square in Istanbul that sparked these protests, the mall designed after an Ottoman army barracks. And we'll hear the history of that and why that is symbolic during the course of this hour. There is also concern about Turkey's support for the rebels in Syria. And a lot of attention is paid to this country, which is considered a model democracy or has been in this part of the world. So all of this is of great concern to many. We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour, starting with Denise Natali, Minerva Chair of the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University and author of The Kurds and the State, Evolving National Identity in Iraq, Turkey, and Iran. And later in the hour, Ross Wilson will be joining us, Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, and he served as American ambassador to Turkey from 2005 to 2008 and also to Azerbaijan from 2000 to 2003. We'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, feel free to leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Denise Natali, thank you very much for joining us. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you for having me. I just would like to say that these views are my own and they don't represent that of the United States government or the Department of Defense.
All right. To start off. Understood.
Thank you.
This, according to my reading of this, started over the public space, green space in Istanbul, a park that the government wanted to make into, and maybe they are doing this right now, I don't know, into a mall that really symbolizes Ottoman army barracks. Is that correct?
That's one of the impetus behind it, but really this is not the key issue. Yes. There was a mobilization because this is one of the only green spaces that people could enjoy in Istanbul. But this is a larger issue that you can see has been bubbling for quite some time. And this goes back to the roots of Turkish identity, that this new political leadership, not very new, under Prime Minister Erdogan, has gradually Islamized these spaces. This is so that Islamizing institutions, the very secular nature of Turkish identity. And these demonstrators in Istanbul, who Prime Minister refers to as bums and hooligans, these are intellectuals. Mm. These are people committed to this very Turkish identity that, again, and this is one thing after the other, banning alcohol sales in Turkey, limiting the opportunities for women and their own procreative choices, the types of higher educational institutions. So, this type of, whether it's Islamic identity, secular identity, this has been going on for decades in what's become of modern Turkey. But again, it is manifesting itself now in a very large exasperation, a deep criticisms of the AK Party and Erdogan, and how he's moving Turkey forward. And then we can, you mentioned Syria. So these are larger issues that enough was enough. And this is where it is at now. It's far beyond the green space in Istanbul.
Can you give us a little bit of history here, how Turkey established a republic, how it became westernized, how it was brought from the Ottoman Empire into the 20th century?
Sure, and it's really a remarkable history.
It is, yes.
That it is amazing what Turkish leader, the creator and the founder of modern Turkey, Kemal Atatürk, forged and built a modern secular Turkish state after the decline of the Ottoman Empire in 1924, after the Turkish Revolution, after the Turkish Revolution of Independence, excuse me, again, so that this Ottoman institution with some of these very antiquated institutions became, again, what Ataturk was to say, a modern and civilized country. Latinizing the alphabet in these terms was movement toward modernization, looking toward the world and the West, developing the state institutions and the economy. And again, you have, although it's being chipped away, these modern educational, higher educational institutions, and a movement toward democratizing the country came later in 1946 with the first democratic elections. All of this was rooted in this commitment to this secular Turkish state. Over time, of course, Turkey also has, it's an Islamic country, and there is a Sunni Muslim tradition. And I believe it was this very draconian method, however, in which Ataturk modernized the Turkish state, all backlash of religious communities. You saw this over time with certain easing of the Islamic institutions over. And again, backlash toward the secular community led by Ataturk or Kemalists, which by the 1970s or 80s had so many different interpretations of who was committed to Kemalism. But nonetheless, you had these two currents moving westward toward this and keeping this secular Western identity or Western-leaning identity. And then now what you have with Erdogan, and it started out with a party that was able to reach out to the impoverished people in Istanbul to provide services, which is what most Islamic parties or Islamic-leaning parties are able to do successfully, was able to grasp the support of a large segment of Turkish population who, again, had been ostracized or alienated by what they perceived was an overly secularized, overly militant, because there also was a large complicity with the secular Kemalists and the military establishment. So I don't mean to wrap up 80 years in about two or 3 minutes,
right.
But it was a very complex situation. And again, remember that Ataturk was also a model, not only for Turkey, but a model for the state-building formula in Iran and the state-building formulas in other Middle Eastern states, who looked at Turkey as this secular modern form of Turkish, of a Turkish state. Now, the other part of this was the type of Turkish national identity that it built, and that was a highly ethnicized form of Turkish nationalism. That was to be Turkish was to be a Turk. And this is what led to what you see today, the very violent, or what you saw until maybe a couple of months ago, a very violent form of Kurdish nationalism in reaction to this exclusionary form of Turkish ethnic nationalism itself. So with these modernizing ethnic exclusionary state nationalisms led by Ataturk, you also had the unintended consequences on minority populations, particularly the Kurds. So what you're having now, and what the prime minister has done, Erdogan, has tried to renegotiate that identity, renegotiate what it means to be Turkish. And these are some of the debates and discussions they are having in the constitutional changes, in trying to create a ceasefire with the PKK, that yes, Turkey does now have to recognize its minority groups. There is another identity in Turkey. But the extent to which this old establishment and the commitment to Turkish nationalism a la Ataturk can fully change is uncertain.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about Erdogan, who's been in power since 2003. My understanding is that he has won 3 landslide elections. He must have a lot of support, doesn't he?
He has a lot of support in the sense that, one, he was able to economically turn the economy around. I mean, Turkey's growth rate is unsurpassed by any other, at least, countries in the region and in Europe and the United States. So this economic formula, this very pragmatic formula of you know, developing a moderate form of Islam that also reached out to the business community, that reached out to the banking and this, you know, the whole commercial enterprise driven by Erdogan's very pragmatic form of economic development. That's number one. Number two, again, this Islamic party, the AK party, was able to reach out to impoverished communities in some of these areas, feeding on this very popular personality of Erdogan. He may not have be foreign policy savvy, but he's able to reach out to Turkish populations and these conservative Turkish populations in this populist appeal. Third, there is, even today, not a very cohesive opposition. The CHP and is there, but there is not a leader yet that can still challenge this dynamic personality of Erdogan. Mm-hmm. With that said, there has been important changes since the Syrian civil war, with the increasing Islamic tendencies of the Erdogan, this wonderful separation of religion and state that was so known to Turkey is now slowly disappearing, that you're starting to see very great opposition to Erdogan. The Alevi population, which could be spilling over sentiments from Syria, even though there's differences between the Alevites and the Alevis, nonetheless, this new forms of exclusionary spaces, not only against non-Islamic communities like the Alevis, but secular communities as well. So this, you know, support for Erdogan that was so embedded a couple of years ago is not as solid as it is today. But again, the question remains, who could challenge him in a future election? And if there was a popular leader, a charismatic leader, then I would be a bit more confident.
What about the president, Abdullah Gül? There have been reports that the two could face each other in the presidential election next year. Is he more conciliatory?
Yes, I mean, people say, I mean, you know, there's my opinion and then there's out there, that President Gül is a more conciliatory leader. Again, there are also tendencies and affiliations with the Gülen movement, but as the president, he has been an individual who has been at least less contentious, but that's the role of the president itself, which was a symbolic leader. The problem here is that Erdogan, who is prime minister, who wants to change, because this would be his last term as prime minister, wants to change the constitution and the rights for him to be able to now become president and to change the Turkish system, parliamentary to a presidential system. Should that occur, he would, the nature of the president, the president's role would also change and give the president a whole different type of authority that would be stronger than the current prime minister today. So there are personalities, but there's also the institution of the presidency itself. I do think that yes, President Gül is a conciliatory and more moderate leader.
Tell me more, before we go to phone calls, about Turkey's policy of supporting the rebels in Syria, what kind of spillover there has been inside Turkey as a result of that.
Yes, this has been, in my view, a big mistake. The Turkish population majority is against Turkish intervention in Syria and against these policies that Erdogan has engaged in Syria. There has been very important spillover from the very beginning. The Syrian opposition was closely affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, which was, of course, based in Istanbul. And so Turkey was complicit in the beginning, and therefore this neutral position that it could have assumed has now become very political. Turkey can no longer be a neutral player. Secondly, over time, as the Syrian opposition changed and it changed its name, they went, you know, there was the second meeting or later on that was in Doha, and there were different actors that became part of it, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. Turkey tried to take a back seat in some sense of letting some of the Gulf Arab states take the lead. The problem was, again, that this opposition now funding and engaging and supporting militarily more radicalized groups was still linked to Turkey because, as reports indicate, some of these weapons were being channeled through Turkey and to the Syrian opposition. Again, we have to be fair because Turkey has taken on over 100,000 refugees. It should be commended for the way it has handled the refugee camps and the refugees in these camps. So that needs to be stated. However, it's the tacit support or the support for some of the more radical groups has undermined a neutral or positive role that Turkey can play in moving forward. And this has spilled over into, as we've seen, the bombing on the border in Reyhanlı, which is a mixed Arab, Alawite population, and the perception, and this is the key, that the Prime Minister Erdogan is not even-handed here, that there is a Sunni-Muslim agenda. There's a highly sectarian agenda that has spilled over into Iraq. This is not just Syria. And again, to be fair, Iran is deeply embedded in this as well. So this is not just Turkey and Erdogan pushing forward, but it has changed, certainly, the tone. And I think, you know, Turkish populations don't want to have these problems, what they some perceive as instigated by Erdogan, now spilling over into Turkey.
We welcome phone calls for Denise Natali. She is chair of the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University and author of The Kurds and the State, Evolving National Identity in Iraq. We're talking about national identity in Turkey this hour and the reasons for what began as peaceful protests over plans to turn a park into a shopping center with political implications turned violent over the weekend, but it goes way beyond that, as you've just heard her explain. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Later in the hour, the former ambassador, American ambassador to Turkey from 2005 to 2008, who is now director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we figure it's summertime, almost. Daniel Golden will be joining us from Boswell Books, and we'll get marvelous suggestions for summertime reading. Two phone calls now. Tim in Eau Claire is our first caller. Hi, Tim.
Hi. It's my understanding that the ruling party in Turkey has many times been compared to the ruling party, well, not ruling party, has been referred to as the Republican Party of Turkey, if that makes sense. Very religious right, although they're not Christian, they're Muslim. But with that being said, you know, they have a lot of the same general ideas and policies and the same kind of lean. Even to the point where, I'm not sure, was it the prime minister or the president who was jailed for making overly religious comments in the past? Does any of that sound familiar?
Are you talking about the current party, ruling party today is the AK party. The previous party that was ruling, Kemal was the Republican. CHP is also the secular party. What you have now is Prime Minister Erdogan's AK party is what some people refer to as a similar Christian Democratic Party, but an Islamic Democratic Party. A more moderate is what they like to say, a more moderate form of Islamic party that has taken measures against secularism and secular institutions and identities in Turkey.
Then was the prime minister or the president? I remember hearing somewhere that they had been sentenced to prison for 11 months or something to that effect, but only served four of it.
This has been yes. This has been while there was he was mayor of Istanbul, and then there were previous Islamic mayors of Istanbul who have been in the past imprisoned. Yes, there has been contentions again that went way back, and this is what made Erdogan a symbol, almost a hero to many of the people. It's, you know, to look right now and say, well, all these things that he's doing. But back then, there was a perceived discrimination against leaders who had Islamic tendencies, and he was one that was discriminated against, or at least in jail, years ago.
Tim, thanks very much for the call. And I understand that there has been a hospitalization of a Turkish lawmaker, a member of the Kurdish party, who had become a participant in the protests. He was hit by a tear gas canister.
This just happened. I'm hearing about it. Was it part of? I know that there have also been outbreaks of violence, small violence between the PKK or some group during this on a different part. But I didn't know that one of the protesters was.
How many people have been rounded up in all of these protests? Significant numbers?
Yes, I mean, it depends. You know, every morning I had my colleague who's Turkish and sent me photos, and there's dozens. What's happened today, you know, I don't know what the official numbers are. There's been a couple of people killed already. There's been dozens injured, and this is going on. It's far more serious. You know, it's continuing,
yes.
And it's moving outside of Istanbul, and it's in Ankara and other cities, and moving.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain? I thought this was an interesting part of the story as well. There are so many fronts to this story. A New York Times story yesterday, I believe, said that in ghettos across the city, the urban poor are being paid to leave their homes so that contractors, many with ties to government officials, can build gated communities.
Huh. Yeah, this is... I'm not, you know, surprised about this because, again, some of the very tendencies that brought Erdogan his popularity in Istanbul, which was catering and to the poorer communities, are now being forgotten, and it's those very poor communities that his policies are undermining. And so, you know, again, the prime minister used to be a very poor man. He's now a leading businessman in Turkey. He's got the interests of the business community that he needs to support as well.
And
so
yet the business
would not be surprising.
The business community must be a little disturbed that the stock market went down fairly significantly yesterday.
I'm sure that was not one of the unintended consequences. And again, people have a tendency to look at Turkey and keep saying how there's this boom and this wonderful moving forward. But the political dimension of this, I can't emphasize, particularly the spillover of Turkey, of Syria, is not over.
And we have heard that there has been prosecution and an intimidation of the press in Turkey. Do you have evidence and reports of that?
We can only look at the statements by Human Rights Watch and journalists across borders, that one of the most dangerous places in the world today to be a journalist is Turkey. So you can have reports. You know, I have numerous friends who are journalists in Turkey, and if you write the wrong statement, if you indicate that you're criticizing the prime minister or the party, you will get a phone call, and that would be kind. So there has been an increasing authoritarianism in Turkey, an increasing closure of the political space in Turkey, and the implications for journalists are very dangerous.
Denise,
you're seeing a much closed, much more closed space, you know, to express alternative ideas, which was never the case in Turkey. Turkey was one of the models of democratic potential in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Denise, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Kathleen.
Denise Natale, Minerva Chair of the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University and author of The Kurds in the State, Evolving National Identity in Iraq, Turkey, and Iran. Ambassador Ross Wilson is joining us now, Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council and a lecturer in international affairs at the George Washington University. Ross Wilson served as American ambassador to Turkey from 2005 to 2008 and ambassador to Azerbaijan from 2000 to 2003. Feel free to call, too. We're just learning about all the details and some of the history of Turkey this hour of the program. So call with whatever your question may be, historical question or reasons for the protests and why it is a matter of concern to many people in the region and to many people in the world. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, and Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Ambassador Ross Wilson, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Are you worried about democracy in Turkey?
Not in the long term, no. I think the fact that people have taken to the streets to express themselves, particularly what took place over the weekend, is a reflection of a democratic system, of a raucous democratic system, one that's different than ours, and frankly from some others in Europe. But Turkey has a pretty consistent track record of having had free and fair elections. There have been no questions about really whether those elections reflect the will of the voters. There remain vestiges of an authoritarian system that goes back 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. The authorities presently in office are not above using those elements of the authoritarian system for their own purposes. But I think in the broad sweep of things, Turkey is a more democratic and more liberal country today, maybe not over the last couple of days, but today in general than it was 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. And that's a good thing, even as we regret and are shocked by what's happened in the last few days.
Mm-hmm. We spent some time the first half hour talking about Turkish identity and talking a little bit about Turkish history. Is there a problem with Turkish identity at this moment? Is there an attempt on the part of Erdogan to make it more of an Islamic nation?
Well, clearly there's been there have been a set of changes that have been taking place in Turkey over the last 30 or 40 years that have utterly transformed the country and led to a variety of reassessments about what it is, about what is the system of governance that Kemal Atatürk established, what are the social systems that were established together with the new Turkish Republic in the aftermath of World War One. You have profound changes. 30 years ago, three-quarters of the Turkish population lived in the countryside. Today, three-quarters live in the cities. They've moved to the cities. They've brought their conservative views and their conservative way of life to those cities. The AK Party, Justice and Development Party, that Prime Minister Erdogan leads, is the party that has tapped into that new rising middle class that has conservative values, and that is leading to some through the what I would characterize as the democratic process has led to a lot of reevaluation of a whole lot of things. That is a source of aggravation for Turkey's older or more traditional elites, and that's part of what you saw played out on the streets of Istanbul, especially over the weekend.
Mm-hmm. Our previous guest was saying that the demonstrations are much more than over the green spaces, what it is to become of parks, that it has to do with support for rebels in Syria, that it has to do with national identity, etc., and the demonstrations seem to be spreading across Turkey. Can you assess the nature of the opposition?
Well, I would say first, the previous speaker is absolutely right. This is not about a park, although it started out as a protest about a park, and its mishandling by the authorities in grossly over-responding with use of force allowed this to transform itself into a broader protest against Prime Minister Erdogan and against his government. I would say it's not so specifically about government support for rebels in Syria. There's a long list of things, some of which has already been referred to. The view among many in Istanbul that the government is both authoritarian and has Islamist aspirations to transform Turkish governance and Turkish societies in ways inimical to their interests. A measure that was passed, I think, last week that limits alcohol sales in terms of the hours and locations in which it can be sold, that fed into this. The announcement by Erdogan, actually, the naming by Erdogan of a new bridge across the Bosporus Strait named after a somewhat odious Ottoman emperor, Sultan, who is associated in Turks' minds with the persecution of the Alevi minority in Turkey, which is similar to the Alawite minority in Syria, although they're not the same thing. That was viewed as insulting by the Alevis, who account for about 20% of the population, and by a lot of others.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have opposition to the government's policies in Syria, which are deeply unpopular in the country. You have misgivings about the government's opening with respect to the Kurds and the discussions with the PKK and kind of where that is headed, concerns about muzzling of the media that was also referred to. So there's a whole basket of things that basically boil down to a view by tens of thousands of people, if not many more, that they wanted to take to the streets and make a strong statement of protest about Erdogan and about the policies of his government.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them. Bob in Duluth. Hi, Bob.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I have a little different kind of a question regarding the European Union. Turkey, from what I understand, with the support of the U.S., pretty strong support, I think, has been trying to gain membership into the European Union. And I'm wondering where that stands now vis-a-vis these new developments and some of the other things that have gone on in the recent past. Has the European Union made any statements? Has anything like that changed in the membership application, so to speak?
Sure. Turkey got a decision out of the European Union in 2004 to initiate accession talks with the EU. Those talks sort of stumbled along for a couple of years until 2006 when, to make a long story short, the EU attached a whole number of, from Turkey's point of view, a whole number of new conditions and put severe limitations on the accession discussions. And so since 2006, the accession process has moved extremely slowly. Neither side has abandoned it. Turkish leaders have complained bitterly about that the EU has backtracked and not lived up to its obligations. EU leaders have more or less complained along similar lines. And the right conclusion is that today those talks are relatively frozen, although there has been a little bit of movement earlier this year, the opening of one chapter. But it was not a meaningful step forward. I think that the EU leaders made a statement either yesterday or over the weekend that was similar to the statements that came out of the White House and the State Department, that called for calm, that called for police restraint, called for respect of the rule of law and reestablishment of order. I don't think that the events the last couple of days per se have changed those discussions or have led to any immediate change in the way that European Union leaders look at Turkey. Turkish accession is deeply unpopular in Turkey, in the European Union, has been all most of EU countries, has been all along. This may modestly add to people's aggravations and the views of many in Europe that Turkey is not frankly a fit partner. I suspect there are also some who remember reasonably well that European police forces also sometimes have problems controlling large and unruly crowds. And you think back to the violence in Paris against Muslims in 2006. There have been riots elsewhere in Europe, and police don't always respond in the right way. That in and of itself should not necessarily be a showstopper. Clearly, Turkey needs to deal with this matter effectively, both in terms of restoring order and in reassuring Europeans and, frankly, Americans and others of their commitment and the government's commitment to democratic values.
I'd like for you to give us an assessment of how things have changed. I think that many of us have this vision of Turkey as being or has been a shining example of vibrant intellectual life, thriving theater and culture, a modern country. a place that we have looked up to with strong alliances with the United States, and really an example of a vibrant life of the mind, tolerant kind of country. How have things changed, and do you worry about how conservative and repressive this country could become?
As I indicated earlier, Turkey is undergoing some profound transformations that have to do with migration of peoples, that have to do with very rapid economic development over a short period of time, and a transformation of Turkey's politics from a situation that was really dominated by a small number of secular, very Western-focused parties that catered to or played to the interests of the elites, the economic and other elites of Istanbul and a few other cities in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, to the kind of Turkey that exists today that is just almost completely transformed itself.
Mm.
And one way of putting it is that the new elites that run the country are, and in particular, the people that they represent, maybe that's a better way to put it, the constituents that they represent are less instinctively drawn to the West than the elites that ran a country 20 years ago or 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they're anti-Western or that they're anti-American, and frankly, the most stridently anti-American voices in Turkey over the last 8 or 10 years have been the secular voices. Much more so than from the ruling Justice and Development Party or the people around them, but you have a lot of change that's going on. Its ultimate destination is not entirely clear. You know, if you've got this core constituency of the present ruling party that's not instinctively drawn to the West in the same way its predecessors were, there are all these rapidly changing and moving, evolving social and economic pieces. The ultimate destination of Turkey is perhaps less clear than it was, 10 years ago. And it's not a function mm-hmm. of these demonstrations that have taken place in the last few days. One could have said the same thing, and I have said the same thing a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. In that situation, certainly while I was serving as American ambassador in Turkey, our approach was to try to do everything we could to keep Turkey as close as we could with the United States. Keep it beside us, and keep it with us, keep America engaged there, so that to the extent that we can, and it's not a huge extent, but to the extent that we can help to ensure that longer-term evolution in Turkish society, economy, and politics remains one that's more favorable to American interests and less unfavorable, given the importance of the country in an extremely volatile region.
Russ Wilson is our guest this part of the program. We're talking about Turkey this hour. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Turkey from 2005 to 2008 and was ambassador to Azerbaijan. Before that, he is now director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council and a lecturer in international affairs at George Washington University. Our phone number, Bob, thanks for your call. We have a couple lines open, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we'll be talking about the de-extinction movement, the idea of walking down the street and maybe seeing a woolly mammoth or a dinosaur. The idea has been around for a while, spurred on in popular culture by the film, of course, Jurassic Park. The scientific community got a boost last week. It was announced that Russian researchers found a preserved mammoth complete with flowing blood and muscle tissue. So maybe the revival of an extinct species is no longer a fantasy. Is it a good idea? We'll talk about it tomorrow. It should be a fascinating conversation. Ambassador Ross Wilson is our guest now, and let us go to Tom in Madison. Hello, Tom.
Hello. I have a question plus two sub-questions. One, what is our administration's policy toward Turkey? Are we supporting either side or saying nice things for either side? And two, what is the position of our allies in Europe? Are any of them involved, or have they been asked to be involved? Three, do we still have an ambassador there, or has that person left because of all the turmoil? And I'll listen to the answers off the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure. The administration has made strong statements of concern about what's happening. The White House put out a statement, put out two statements over the weekend. Secretary Kerry spoke publicly at an event yesterday in all cases calling for calm, talking extensively about the need for police restraint in dealing with crowds. And for finding the right balance as governments and police forces try to both ensure order and respect the rights of peaceable demonstrators and those seeking to express their views in a peaceful and normal way. European leaders have spoken along the same lines. The specific statement I remember is by the President of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz, who said essentially the same thing that the United States did. But other EU foreign ministers and leaders, I think, have spoken out as well. The American ambassador, Frank Ricciardone, remains in Ankara. He was actually supposed to be in Washington for meetings the first part of this week of the American-Turkish Council, which has its annual convention at this time of year. His departure from the United States was put off in response to these developments, and in particular in a context of substantial demonstrations relatively close to both the American embassy in Ankara as well as the ambassador's residence.
Hmm. What about Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki saying his government worried about the security implication of the situation in Turkey? Turkey, an essential part, he says, of the stability of the region. What security worries does he have?
Oh, I think Maliki is not really referring to actual security worries. He is referring at least indirectly to remarks that Prime Minister Erdogan and other Turkish leaders have had about his actions, Maliki's actions, and the behavior of the Baghdad government that have created defense, security, and political issues. Again, this is what Turks have said, defense and security issues for Turkey and for other countries around it. The Turkish authorities have for some time been concerned about Maliki's dictatorial tendencies, about his very close ties with Iran, and Iraqi government collusion in resupplying the Assad regime at Damascus, especially from Iran, and so that's the tit for tat game that's going on there. The border that Iraq and Turkey share is monitored by and controlled by the Kurdistan Regional Government in the north. Baghdad's authority up there is relatively limited, and by extension, its security concerns about the north are relatively limited as well.
Hmm. I'm just interested, Ambassador Wilson, in some of your personal impressions from living in the country from 2005 to 2008. What you personally saw as a Turkish identity, if you enjoyed your time there, if you saw a lot of rumblings of what we're seeing today?
I had a fantastic time in Turkey.
Did you?
It's an extremely interesting country.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely important to the United States, and that makes being the American ambassador there a pretty interesting, sometimes very challenging, but a pretty interesting opportunity. And it is going through, as you were discussing a moment ago, this dramatic reappraisal of what it is, of who they are, of what kind of society they're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and on top of that, there's all this history that goes back a couple thousand years that also makes the country interesting. There are layers upon layers that you can drill down into. Turkey is a strongly secular and westernized society in ways that we don't fully appreciate. The Justice and Development Party and I would say, in particular, Erdogan and the people around him are more, they appreciate the connection that Turkey has with the United States. They know that the success of their country and the success of their country's foreign policy agenda depends upon a close relationship with the United States. But it's also a very complicated relationship. You'll recall Turkey has had several military coups, most recently in 1980, And then what Turks refer to as the postmodern coup, in which the military indirectly organized the removal of a democratically elected government in the mid-1990s. Turks commonly blame that on the United States. And blame all those things on the United States and believe that we were, if not directly involved, that we were at least complicit somehow. And that plus the American intervention in Iraq created acute problems, creates acute problems for American policy and American diplomacy there. Something that we have to be very careful in working with and working around. Having said that, it's a very proud country. It's a strong place. They're wonderful people, extremely friendly, and although anti-American sentiment was relatively high during most of my time, it never affected me or the way that the Turks dealt with me, whether it was officials or the man on the street.
Let's go to John in Richland Center. Hi, John.
Hi. I just want to ask you a question as far as the spice trade. And I'm surprised that Turkey was able to stay out of the Arab Spring, and now you got Syria going. And Turkey is right in the middle.
Would you consider this a part of an Arab Spring, Ambassador?
Well, it's not obviously like the Arab Spring. For one thing, Turkey's government is democratically elected, and no one has challenged going back as decades, no one has challenged the legitimacy or the probity of the election results as they were reported, or the legitimacy of the governments that are in office. And that's for Erdogan as well as his predecessors. And that's sharply different from the situation that you saw in Egypt, in Tunisia, Libya, in Syria today. Clearly, there are issues, important issues that the demonstrators have referred to that. In general, one could refer to as respect for minority rights and full respect for other rights, including freedom of expression and freedom of the media.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's something going on there. I think it's important that leaders across the political spectrum just today and yesterday have virtually all spoken out for calm. Turks are repelled by the violence that they have seen. Erdogan is out of the country, but one of his deputy prime ministers today apologized for excessive use of force. He referred to those who demonstrated over the weekend as patriots, said what they did was legitimate and righteous, was a legitimate and righteous reaction to what was happening in this park and the issues around Taksim Square. Those are not reactions of a Mubarak government or an Assad government. Clearly, there's overuse of force by the military. But I think my sense is this is not an Arab Spring. It may be a Turkish Spring, but it will have it has different origins. Mm. It will play out in very different ways, and I think in much less cataclysmic ways for American interests. Turkey's a strong, secure country, will remain so.
Erdogan left the country at this time?
Erdogan left Monday morning on a long previously scheduled trip to North Africa, ironically to talk about democratic values.
Oh my goodness!
in several of the Arab Spring countries, Morocco and Tunisia, there may be maybe one or two others. It is interesting that he left. It is in looking at it in the abstract, his departure may in fact be a way to kind of lower the temperature. Other people, his deputy prime minister today, President Gül yesterday, and also the day before, other people are calling for calm and maybe better place than the prime minister was, certainly judging by what he had to say over the weekend, to try to calm the public temperature. And I'm told today the streets were substantially calmer, especially during the day, that it may have picked up in the evening.
Interesting. In about 30 seconds, can you tell us what support Turkey is giving to the rebels in Syria?
Turks are scared to death about what's happening in Syria. Clearly, the authorities have been complicit in making aid available to rebel groups, and in particular to Sunni groups, the Muslim Brotherhood and others, but they're very nervous about what's happening there and about the wider implications for the Middle East. Mm.
Thank you ever so much for being with us. You're a wealth of information. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Our guest this last part of the hour, he's a former ambassador, Ambassador Ross Wilson. He's now director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, a lecturer in international affairs at George Washington University, American ambassador to the country 2005 to 2008, and also to Azerbaijan from 2000 to 2003. We also thank Denise Natali for being with us the first part of the program. It's a fascinating country, isn't it? And I learned a lot this hour. Reminder, tomorrow we'll be talking about the de-extinction movement, a pioneer in the field of de-extinction and the author of a recent National Geographic article on the science behind it will be joining us. And coming up right after the news from National Public Radio, one of our favorite book people, Daniel Golden, will be here with many books. He'll spread out in front of him, and we will talk summer reading. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this show.